for 3 return tickets. He was going to ask Keiko to leave with him. He would give her his button and try to sneak her out during a visit. Anything was worth trying at this point. She could stay at his Auntie King's house on Beacon Hill, or so he thought. Unlike his father, Auntie King had no qualms about her Japanese neighbors. She had said so herself one time, much to Henry's surprise. Somehow, she was more forgiving, more accepting. It was a long shot, but it was his last, best hope in the current situation.
"You know where this place is?" Sheldon asked.
"I know how it was in Puyallup, at Camp Harmony. If we get close enough, we're going to have a hard time not knowing where it is."
"Well, how can you be so certain?"
Henry cut him off.
"There's supposed to be 9,000 people imprisoned there. That's like a small city. It's not going to be a problem finding the camp. The problem will be finding Keiko among all those people."
Sheldon whistled, to the dismay of an elderly woman in a fur hat, who turned around and scowled at him. Henry didn't mind sitting in the back of the bus, but for some reason, Sheldon seemed to resent it, grousing once in a while about how this was the Northwest and not the Deep South, and the bus driver had had no business jerking his thumb toward the back of the bus when he and Henry boarded. Still, they went. Going this far, to someplace unknown, was potential trouble enough. The good thing about sitting in the last row was not having anyone behind them to stare or ask questions. Henry pretty much disappeared into the rear corner of the bus, looking out the window, and those glaring back didn't even make eye contact with Sheldon.
"What happens if we get there, and no one rents us a place to lay our heads for the night?" Henry asked.
"We'll manage. Not the first time I slipped out of doors, you know."
But despite Sheldon's optimistic attitude, Henry had a very real concern. Right before all the Japanese were evacuated from Bainbridge Island, Keiko's uncle and his family had tried to resettle somewhere farther inland, where the Japanese were scrutinized less. Some Japanese families were encouraged to leave voluntarily. Some even thought doing so would prevent incarceration. The problem was that no one would sell gasoline to those families fleeing the city, or rent them a room. Even places that were virtually vacant turned them away, or put up their closed signs as the Japanese families got out of their cars. Keiko's uncle had made it as far as Wenatchee, Washington, before being forced to turn back, because no one would sell him any gas. He turned back and was rounded up like the rest. Henry thought about sleeping outside and was grateful he had brought extra clothing. September brought rain and cold weather, at least in Seattle. Who knew what it would be like in Idaho this time of year? 6 hours later, they made it to Walla Walla, a small farming community known for its apple orchards. Henry and Sheldon had 45 minutes for lunch. Then they'd board again for Twin Falls, then on to Jerome, Idaho, which they assumed would lead to Camp Minidoka. As soon as he stepped out on the sidewalk, Henry immediately felt self-conscious, like the eyes of the world were on him, and Sheldon too. There wasn't a person of color anywhere in sight, not even an Indian, which Henry had expected to find in a town named after an Indian tribe. Instead, they were greeted with buttoned-up white folk, all of whom seemed to take notice. Despite that, no one appeared unfriendly. They simply regarded him and Sheldon and went about their business. Still, Henry fidgeted with his "I am Chinese" button, and Sheldon said,
"Let's go find something to eat. Just don't make eye contact, you hear?"
Henry knew that Sheldon wasn't originally from Seattle. He'd grown up in Tacoma, but was born in Alabama. His parents had left the South when he was 5 or 6, and evidently he'd seen enough to never want to return. He still called grown men and little boys sir, and tipped his hat and said ma'am. But aside from that, he wanted no part of the South. And judging by Sheldon's hurried reaction to the people on the streets of Walla Walla, this might as well have been Birmingham.
"Where are we gonna go?"
Sheldon looked at the windows of stores and restaurants.
"Well, I don't know. Maybe this isn't as bad as I'd thought."
"What do you mean, bad?"
"Well, I mean, look." and you see for yourself. Ain't no one even really concerned with us. And I don't see any whites-only signs in the windows.
They walked down the street, past people who seemed to notice them. But instead of pulling their children to the far side of the road, they just waved, which was all the more bewildering. He and Sheldon finally stopped at the grand entrance of what must have been the tallest building in town, the Marcus Whitman Hotel. Inside, a coffee shop could be plainly seen.
"What do you think?" Henry asked.
"This is as good as any. Let's go around back and order something to go."
"Out back?" Henry asked.
"Ain't no need to be taking chances, Henry. We've come this far."
"Can I help you two with something?"
An older gentleman must have crossed the street behind them. His question made Sheldon bolt upright, and Henry stepped behind him.
"You two aren't from around here, are you?"
Henry swallowed hard.
"No, sir. We're just passing through. In fact, we're heading back to our bus right now." "Well, since you've come all the way down, might as well go on in and grab a cup of something warm."
Henry watched the man crane his neck and look down the street to the bus depot.
"Looks like you've got time. Welcome to Walla Walla, and I hope you come back and see us again."
He handed Henry and Sheldon a small pamphlet and tipped his hat.
"God bless."
Henry watched him walk away, confused. What place is this, he wondered. Does he think I'm Japanese? He looked at his button, then up at Sheldon, who was skimming the brochure and scratching his head, a surprised yet relieved look on his face. The small pamphlet was from an Adventist church, a group Henry had known was lending charitable aid to imprisoned Japanese families, volunteering as teachers and nurses. As it turned out, there was a large congregation, even a private church college here. As he and Sheldon grabbed a quick meal of coffee and toast, they looked around and made eye contact with folks around them. Not everyone was afraid. Some even smiled back. Finding the camp was easy. In a way, that made Henry feel more than a little saddened. As he and Sheldon stepped off the bus in Jerome, Henry couldn't help but notice an enormous sign that read, "Minidoka Wartime Relocation Center, 18 miles. There were dozens of people loading into trucks and cars, all bound for what had become the seventh largest city in Idaho. Sheldon adjusted his hat.
"Relocation Center. They make it sound like it's the Chamber of Commerce, helping people find a new home or something."
"It's their new home now," was all Henry could muster.
A woman with a nurse's cape rolled down the window of a blue sedan.
"You two must be going to the camp. Need a ride?" she asked.
Henry and Sheldon looked at each other. Was it that obvious? It seemed that everyone in the bus depot had business up north. They both nodded vigorously.
"That truck behind me is taking visitors, if that's what you're planning."
Henry pointed to a large flatbed hay truck with makeshift benches and a rickety boarded siding.
"That truck?"
"That's the one. Better hurry if you're planning on going. They won't wait much longer."
Sheldon tipped his hat and grabbed his suitcase, nudging Henry.
"Thank you, ma'am. We're much obliged."
They walked to the back of the truck and climbed up, sitting next to a pair of nuns and a priest who spoke to one another in what appeared to be Latin, occasionally mixing in some conversational Japanese.
"Looks like this might be easier than you thought,"
Sheldon said, sliding his suitcase between his feet.
"Bigger than you thought, too."
Henry nodded, looking around. He was the only Asian person in sight, let alone in the truck. But he was Chinese. China was an ally of the United States. And he was a U.S. citizen to boot. That had to count for something, right? Looking at the horizon, Henry could see the camp from 5 miles away. A massive rock chimney rose above the dry, dusty fields, which eventually revealed the layout of a small city. Everything appeared to be still under construction. Even from a distance, Henry could make out the skeletal frames of enormous rows of buildings. Sheldon saw it too.
"That must be 1,000 acres, easy," he said.
Henry didn't know how much that was, but it was huge.
"Can you believe that?" Sheldon asked. It's like a city rising up out of the Snake River. Everything's so dry and barren this far north. Now they just dump everyone here.
Henry stared at the arid landscape. There were no trees or grass or flowers anywhere, and barely any shrubs. Just a living, breathing landscape of tar-paper barracks, spotting the dry desert terrain. And people. Thousands of people. Most of them seemed to be working on the buildings, or in the fields, picking corn, potatoes, or sugar beets. Even small children and elderly people could be seen hunched over in the dusty furrows. Everyone was very much alive and in motion. The truck lumbered over a patchwork of potholes, brakes squealing as it rattled to a halt. As passengers unloaded, camp workers were pointed in one direction, and visitors in another. Henry and Sheldon followed the small herd of people who crowded into a stone visitor's room. With the wind blowing, Henry could taste the dust in the air and feel the grit on his skin. The land was dry and parched, but there was an indescribable smell. Sweetgrass, and the smell of rain coming. Being from Seattle, Henry knew that smell all too well. A storm was blowing in. Inside, they were instructed on what could and could not be brought to and from the camp. Things like cigarettes and alcohol were allowed in small quantities, but fairly benign things like nail files were forbidden.
"I guess a huge pair of wire cutters is out of the question," Henry whispered to Sheldon, who just nodded and tipped his head.
If the sight of a Chinese boy was unusual, it was hardly noticed in the hectic comings and goings of Camp Minidoka. Even Henry, who at first was certain he'd be swept up at bayonet point and taken into the heart of the camp, was surprised at how hardly anyone noticed him. How could they? There were thousands of prisoners to process, and more buses of prisoners were arriving by the hour. The camp was still breathing and lurching to life, finding its rhythm, a growing community behind barbed wire fences.
"Hope you took a bath before we left," Sheldon said, looking out the window. "'Cause those are sewer lines they're digging in out there."
Henry sniffed at his sleeve, smelling sweaty and musty like the bus ride. Sheldon wiped his brow with a handkerchief.
"It'll be months before they get hot water or flushing toilets."
Henry looked at the Japanese workers laboring in the sun. The sight made him thankful for being indoors as he and Sheldon waited in line. It was 30 minutes before they were allowed to register as visitors. Finally, a file clerk checked camp records to see if the Okabe family had arrived.
"They're Quakers," Sheldon commented to Henry, nodding in the direction of the office staff.
"Like the oatmeal guy?"
"Something like that. They objected to the war and all that. Now they volunteer in the camps, teaching, filling in as nurses and stuff. At least that's what I hear. Most of the white folks here is Quakers. Though this is Idaho, so some of them are Adventists, probably. Same thing, I guess."
Henry peeked at the white woman behind the desk. She looked like Betty Crocker. Average, plain, and pleasant. The woman looked up from her papers, smiling.
"Okabes?"
"They're here, along with a dozen other families with that name. But I think I found who you're after."
Sheldon patted Henry on the shoulder.
"Just head on over to that visitor's room," she pointed, "and I'll help you get oriented. The camp is organized like a city, with streets and blocks. Ordinarily, visits are arranged by letter or by outgoing phone calls, which can occasionally be made from the main office. Otherwise, a runner will be sent into that area of the camp, and a notice will get posted outside the barracks assigned to that family."
Henry tried to follow along, blinking his eyes and rubbing his forehead.
"It normally takes at least a day," she said, "since most of the children are in temporary schoolrooms, and the adults do work inside the camp."
"What kind of work?"
Henry wondered, remembering all the activity outside.
"Just labor. Either harvesting sugar beets or doing construction. Plenty of office work for the women, too."
She sighed as she said it, returning to the pile of papers in front of her. Henry filled out a slip for Keiko, who he'd been told was assigned to Block 17, not too far from this side of Camp Minidoka. He wanted to surprise her, So he just put down visitor and left the name blank. A runner, an older Japanese man, who ironically walked with a limp, took the paper and wandered off.
This could take a while, Henry said.
Sheldon nodded and watched the crowds of visitors shuffle in and out. Sitting on a hard bench between an older man with several boxes of hymnals and a young couple with baskets of pears, Henry looked at Sheldon, watching him crack his knuckles, wishing he'd brought along his saxophone.
Thanks for coming with me, he said.
Sheldon patted Henry's knee.
Needed to be done, that's all. Your old man know you're all the way out here?
Henry solemnly shook his head no.
I told my mother I was leaving for a few days.
She must know. I don't think she knows I'm here, but she knows enough. I'm not saying she likes it, but she let me go and didn't ask. That was the best she could do, I suppose. Her way of helping. She'll be worried and all, but she'll be okay. I'll be okay. I just had to come. I may never see Keiko again. And I didn't want what I said or didn't say at Camp Harmony to be the last thing she ever heard from me.
Sheldon stared off at the people coming and going.
There's hope for you yet, Henry. You wait and see. Might take a while, but there's always hoping.
That while lasted for 6 hours, as he and Sheldon waited and waited, sometimes inside, other times pacing outside the stone visitor center. Thunderheads had rolled in, darkening the sky, even though there were still several hours before sunset. Finally, Henry patted his suitcase, looking at a sign that said visiting hours ended at 5:30.
It's almost time to go back. We left our message. She must not have seen it yet.
But we'll come back tomorrow. She'll find it soon enough, he thought. Outside, thick and heavy raindrops dotted the parched ground. As it hit the tin roofs of the makeshift buildings and half-finished barracks, the rain created a slow, warbling, drumming sound. People everywhere headed for shelter. Henry thought about the tar paper roofs and unfinished buildings. He hoped they were vacant, and the camp's residents occupied the rows sheltered by completed roofs.
"There's a bus for visitors over here," Sheldon pointed,
balancing his suitcase on his head with one hand to keep the rain off as it turned into a downpour. Thunder rumbled far away, but no lightning could be seen. It wasn't that dark yet. Henry tried to imagine what Keiko must have been doing right then, heading home from school with the other Japanese kids. What a strange mix that must be. Some spoke nothing but English, others spoke only Japanese. He thought about Keiko and her family, settling into their one-room quarters, huddled around a pipe stove trying to stay warm, rain dripping into buckets through holes in the roof. He thought about her playing their Oscar Holden record.
Does she think about me? Does she think about me as much as I've thought about her? Could she?
No. Henry thought about her so much he could see her on the streets of Seattle, even hear her voice. Simple and small, sparkling, with perfect English. Like now, speaking his name through the rolling thunder of the rainstorm. As if she was there. As if she'd never left. He was always amazed at how he liked hearing her call his name.
Henry.
From the day they met in the kitchen.
Henry.
To that horrible day when he watched helplessly as she and her family boarded the train for Camp Harmony.
Henry.
And finally, when she said goodbye, in a sheltered, guarded way he'd never seen, as he said farewell and let her go, not wanting to complicate things any more than they already were, wanting to be a good son. That voice had haunted him all these weeks.
Henry?
She was there, standing in the rain, outside the Stone Visitor Center, which was closing for the day, behind the locked gate and rows of barbed wire. Wearing that yellow dress and a gray sweater hanging wet from her small shoulders. Then she was skipping over mud puddles, running to the fence that stood between them.
Henry!
The note from the messenger was wet and crumpled in her hand. Looking through watery eyes, wiping the rain from his face with his sleeve, Henry caught her arms through the fence as they leaned in, his hand slipping down to feel hers, incredibly warm, despite the cold rain. Pressing his forehead to hers, between the gap in the rows of barbed wire, Henry was so close, he could almost feel her eyelashes when she blinked. Their proximity kept their faces somewhat dry, as the rain fell along their cheeks and soaked their collars.
"What are you doing here?"
She blinked away the drops of rain that sprinkled her eyes, running down from a wet strand of hair.
I turned 13.
Henry didn't know what else to say. Keiko didn't say a word. She just reached through the wire and wrapped her arms around his waist.
I left. I came to see you. I'm old enough to make my own decisions, so I took a bus with Sheldon. I needed to tell you something.
Henry looked down, and Keiko's brown eyes seemed to reflect something unseen in the gray September sky. Something glowed from inside.
I'm sorry. For what? For not saying goodbye. You did say goodbye. Not the way I should have. I was so worried about my family. Worried about everything. I was confused. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know what goodbye really was. So you came all this way, all those miles, just to tell me goodbye?
Keiko asked.
No,
Henry said, feeling fuzzy inside. The rain splashing him was cold, but he didn't feel it. His jacket caught and tore on the barbed wire as his hands gently framed her waist, his fingers feeling the soaked sweater. He was leaning in, his forehead pressed against the cold metal wire. If there was something sharp there, he didn't feel it. All he felt was Keiko's cheek, wet from the rain, as she leaned in too.
I came to do that, Henry said. It was his first kiss.
Sheldon Thomas, 1986. Henry stepped out of the rain and into the winding corridors of the Hearthstone Inn, a nursing home over in West Seattle, not too far from the Fauntleroy Ferry Terminal, which connected Seattle with Vashon Island. Henry had been coming more often, now that Ethel had passed, and he had a surplus of time on his hands. The Hearthstone Inn was one of the nicer nursing homes in West Seattle. Nice to Henry, anyway. Not that he was an expert on nursing homes. He was more of an expert on the ones he didn't like. Those cold, gray places, like those state institutions that he'd fought so hard to keep Ethel out of. Those small-windowed cinder-block buildings where people gathered to die, alone. The Hearthstone, by contrast, was more like a rustic hunting lodge or a resort than a rest home. The entrance featured a chandelier made from deer antlers. A nice touch, Henry thought, as he found his way to the one wing he was somewhat familiar with. He didn't bother stopping at the nurse's station. Instead, he went directly to room 42, knocking lightly just below the nameplate that read, Sheldon Thomas. There was no answer, but Henry peeked in anyway. Sheldon slept half upright in his elevated hospital bed. His once robust cheeks, which had ballooned when he played his sax, now simply draped the bones of his face. An IV ran to his wrist, where it was taped along the weathered, crumpled paper bag skin of his forearm. A clear plastic tube went around his ears and hung just below his nose, whistling oxygen into his lungs. A young nurse, someone new whom he didn't recognize, came up to Henry and patted him on the arm.
"Are you a friend or a family member?"
she whispered the question in his ear, trying not to disturb Sheldon. The question hung there like a beautiful chord, ringing in the air. Henry was Chinese. Sheldon obviously wasn't. They looked nothing alike. Nothing at all. I'm distant family, Henry said. The answer seemed sufficient.
We were just about to wake him up to give him some meds, the nurse said. So now's a good time to go on in for a visit. He'll probably be waking up soon anyway. If you need anything, I'll be right outside.
Henry closed the door halfway. A lava lamp, with a bright purple bow on top, was the only light on in the room, aside from the red lights on the various monitors hooked up to his old friend. The curtains were open, and light from the cloudy early afternoon twilight warmed up the room. A gold 45 record hung on the wall in a dusty frame. A single Sheldon's band had recorded in the late 50s. Alongside were photos of Sheldon and his family, children and grandchildren. Drawings in crayon and marker dotted the bathroom door and the wall just beneath where the television hung from the ceiling. A bedside table was covered with small piles of photos and sheet music. Henry sat in the well-worn chair next to the bed and looked at a recent birthday card. Sheldon had turned 74 last week. One of the many monitors began beeping, then went quiet again. Henry watched as Sheldon's mouth opened first in a silent yawn, then his eyes blinking and adjusting to the light. He looked at Henry and smiled an old gold-toothed grin.
"Well, well, how long have you been hanging out?" he asked,
stretching and rubbing his balding pate, flattening out the white hair he had left.
"Just got here."
"Is it Sunday already?"
Sheldon asked, waking up, shifting in his hospital bed.
In the month since Ethel had died, Henry had made a habit of coming over on Sunday afternoons to watch the Seahawks game with Sheldon.
A nurse would help Sheldon into a wheelchair, and they'd go down to the big rec room, the one with the giant rear projection TV. But in recent weeks, Sheldon hadn't had the energy. Now they just watched the game in the quiet of his room. Occasionally, Henry would sneak in a bag of buffalo wings, clam chowder from Ivor's, or another of Sheldon's favorite foods that the nurses wouldn't normally allow. But not today. It wasn't Seahawks Sunday, and he had brought something different to share with Sheldon.
"I came early this week," Henry said, loud enough so Sheldon could hear without his hearing aids in.
"What, you think I ain't gonna make it to Sunday?"
Sheldon laughed. Henry just smiled at his old friend.
"I found something I thought you would like to have. Something I've been looking for. Something you've been looking for. For years."
Sheldon's wide, bloodshot eyes looked at Henry. Youthful wonder filled out his sagging face. It was a look Henry hadn't seen in a long time.
"You got a surprise for me, Henry?"
Henry nodded, smiling. He knew that the old Oscar Holden record meant as much to Sheldon as it did to himself. Maybe for different reasons, but it meant the world to each of them. Oscar Holden had given Sheldon his big break back in 1942. He'd played with Holden for a year after the war ended and the club reopened. Then Sheldon had formed his own band when Oscar passed away years later. The street cred Oscar gave him landed him a lot of long-term gigs and even earned him a modest recording contract with a local label.
"Well, I ain't getting any younger, and Christmas is coming," Sheldon said.
"Now, I found it, but there's one problem.
It's going to need a little restoration before you can play it." "That don't matter none."
As Sheldon spoke, a shaky finger tapped his forehead.
"I still play that song in my head every night. I've heard it. I was there, remember?"
Henry reached into his bag and pulled out the old 78 record, still in its original sleeve. He held it out to show Sheldon, reading him the words on the record label as his friend pawed the side table for his reading glasses.
"Oscar Holden and the Midnight Blue," Sheldon finished Henry's sentence.
Henry handed the record to his old friend, who draped it across his chest. His eyes closed, as if he were listening to the music play, somewhere, sometime,
long ago. Waiting, 1942. Henry woke up on a dingy, straw-filled mattress on the floor, hearing the rain leak through the roof and plip-plop into a half-full laundry basin in the middle of what was the Okabe's living room. To his right was a curtained area where Keiko and her little brother slept on one side and her parents on the other. He could hear Keiko's mother snoring softly, along with the pinging of the rain on the tin roof, a relaxing, melodic sound that made Henry feel like he was still dreaming. Maybe it was a dream. Maybe he was really at home in his own bed, with his window overlooking Canton Alley. The window cracked open despite the wishes of his mother. Henry closed his eyes and inhaled, smelling the rain, but not the fishy, salty air of Seattle. He was here. He had made it all the way to Minidoka. He'd made it even farther, all the way to Keiko's house. She didn't want him to leave, and he didn't want to go. So he'd met Keiko on the other side of the visitor's building. Everything was designed to keep people from escaping, not to keep people from sneaking in. And much to Henry's surprise, he didn't even have to try very hard. He'd just told the surprised yet approving Sheldon that he would meet him the next day, grabbed a stack of school books being carried by a group of Quaker school teachers, and followed them in past the guards. For once in his life, there was a benefit to Caucasian people thinking he was one of them, that he was Japanese. Henry rolled over, rubbing his eyes, and froze mid-yawn. Keiko was lying in her bed, facing him, her chin propped up on her arms and her pillow, staring at him. Her hair was messy, hanging down and sticking out at odd angles, yet somehow it just worked. She smiled, and Henry came alive. He couldn't believe he was here. Even more than that, he couldn't believe that her parents were okay with him being here. His would have thrown him out, probably. But she'd said it would be okay. And somehow it was. Her parents had looked flattered and strangely honored to have a guest in their makeshift home, surrounded by barbed wire, searchlights, and machine gun towers. When Keiko had walked in, Henry could barely bring himself to step through the door. Her parents were bewildered and flattered that Henry had come all this way, but somehow, they didn't seem too surprised. He gathered that Keiko hadn't forgotten about him. In fact, it may have been quite the opposite. Henry turned around so he was closer to Keiko, wrapping the hand-sewn quilt around him as he lay down facing her. She was a few feet away, brushing the hair from her eyes.
"I dreamed you came to see me last night," Keiko whispered. "I dreamed you came all this way because you missed me. And when I woke up, I was so sure it was a dream. And then I looked over, and there you were. I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe your parents. Henry, this isn't about us. I mean, it is, but they don't define you by the button you wear. They define you by what you do, by what your actions say about you. And coming here, despite your parents, says a lot to them, and me. And they're Americans first. They don't see you as the enemy. They see you as a person."
The words were a strange comfort. Was this acceptance? Was that what this was? The sense of belonging was foreign to him, something alien and awkward, like writing with your left hand or putting your pants on inside out. Henry looked at her parents sleeping. They seemed more restful here in this cold, wet place than his own parents in their warm, cozy home.
"I'll have to leave today. Sheldon and I have a bus to catch tonight." "I know. I knew you couldn't stay forever. Besides, one of the other families might turn us in. Your secret we wouldn't be able to keep forever."
Can you keep a secret? Henry asked. Keiko sat up. That must have got her attention, Henry thought, as she fluffed the pillow in her lap, pulling her blanket around her shoulders. She held up two fingers.
Scout's honor, Kimosabe.
I came here thinking I'd be sneaking you out, not you sneaking me in.
And how were you going to do that?
I don't know. I guess I thought I'd give you my button, like at the train station.
You are the sweetest, Henry. And I wish I could. I really do. But you're going to be in enough trouble when you get home. If you came home with me, you'd really get it. We'd both be thrown in jail. Do you want to know a secret?
Henry liked this game, nodding.
I would go. So don't ask, because I would go back with you. I'd try anyway.
Henry was flattered, touched even. The meaning sank in.
Then I guess I'll just wait for you. And I'll write,
Keiko said.
This can't last forever, right?
They both turned toward the window, looking out at the nearby buildings through the rain street glass. Keiko lost her smile.
I don't care how long. I'll wait for you, Henry said.
Keiko's mother stopped snoring and stirred, waking up. She looked at Henry, confused for a moment, then smiled brightly.
Good morning, Henry. How's it feel to be a prisoner for a day?
Henry looked at Keiko.
Best day of my life.
Keiko found her smile. All over again. Breakfast with Keiko's family was rice and tamago, eggs, hard-boiled. It wasn't fancy, but it was filling, and Henry enjoyed it immensely. The Okabes seemed happy to be settled into some place more permanent than the ramshackle horse stalls of the Puyallup fairgrounds. Keiko's mother made a pot of tea, while her father read a newspaper printed inside the camp. Aside from the simple confines and their modest clothing, they seemed like any other American family.
Is it nice not having to go to the mess hall all the time?
Henry tried his best to make polite table conversation in English.
On rainy days, it's always nice,
Keiko's mother said, smiling between bites.
I still can't believe I'm here. Thank you.
There are almost 4,000 of us here now, Henry. And you're our first guest. We're delighted,
Mr. Okabe said. There's supposed to be another 6,000 coming in the next month. Can you believe that?
10,000?
It was a number that still seemed unimaginable to Henry.
With that many people, what's to keep you from just taking over the camp?
Mr. Okabe poured his wife another cup of tea.
Ah, that's a very profound question, Henry, and it's one I've thought about. There are probably 200 guards and army personnel, and there are so many of us. Even if you counted just the men, we'd have a whole regiment in here. You know what keeps us from doing just that?
Henry shook his head. He had no idea.
Loyalty. We're still loyal to the United States of America.
Why?
Because we, too, are Americans. We don't agree, but we will show our loyalty by our obedience. Do you understand, Henry?
All Henry could do was sigh and nod. He knew that concept all too well, painfully well. Obedience as a sign of loyalty, as an expression of honor, even as an act of love, was a well-worn theme in his household. Especially between him and his father. But that wasn't the case now, was it? Did I cause my father's stroke? Was it brought on by my disobedience? As much as Henry reasoned otherwise, he had a hard time convincing himself the answer was no. His guilt remained. But even that's not enough for them, Keiko's mother added.
It's true, in a way. Mr. Okabe said,
sipping his tea. There is a rumor that the War Relocation Authority plans to have each male 17 and over sign an oath of loyalty to the United States. Why? Henry asked, confused. How can they put you here and then expect you to swear an oath of loyalty to them? Keiko broke in. Because they want us to go to war for them. They want to draft men to fight the Germans. That made about as much sense to Henry as his father sending him to an all-white school wearing an I am Chinese button. And we would go. Gladly. I would go, Mr. Okabe said. Many of us offered to join the army right after the bombings at Pearl Harbor. Most were refused. Many were attacked outright. But why would you do that? Why would you want to? Henry asked. Mr. Okabe laughed. Look around you, Henry. It's not like we're living on Park Avenue. And anything I could do to help ease the suffering, and even more, the scrutiny and dishonor done to my family, I would do that. Many of us would do that. But what's more, for some, the only way we can prove we are American is to bleed for America's cause, despite what's being done to us. In fact, it's even more important, in the face of what's been done. Henry began to understand and appreciate the sentiment within that complex web of injustice and contradiction. When are they going to let you fight? He asked. Mr. Okabe didn't know, but he suspected it wouldn't be long after the completion of the camp. Once their labor here was done, they could be used elsewhere. Enough about all that fighting, Henry, Keiko's mother interrupted. We need to figure out how we're going to get you out of here today. She's right, said Mr. Okabe. We're honored that you would come all this way to court Keiko, but it is a very dangerous place. We're so used to it that the soldiers seem normal to us. But there was a shooting a week before we arrived here. Henry blanched a little, feeling the color drain from his face. He wasn't sure what made him more nervous, that his being here was considered part of a formal courtship, which he supposed it was, or that someone had been shot. I suppose I haven't asked permission, Henry said.
To leave?
Said Keiko's mother.
No, permission to court your daughter.
Henry reminded himself again that he was now the same age his father had been when he was betrothed to his mother.
May I?
Henry felt awkward and strange, not because he still felt so young, but because he'd grown up with the Chinese tradition of a go-between, someone who would act as a mediator between families. Traditional courtship involved an exchange of gifts from family to family, tokens of betrothal. None of that was possible now. Mr. Okabe gave him a proud look, the kind Henry always wished his father had given him.
Henry, you have been incredibly honorable in your intentions toward my daughter, and you are a constant help to us as a family. You have my full permission, as if being here sleeping on our floor wasn't permission enough.
Henry perked up, disbelieving what he had asked and what he had heard in reply. He grimaced a bit as he worried about his father, then saw Keiko smiling at him from across the table. She reached over and poured Henry a fresh cup of tea, offering it to him.
Thank you for everything.
Henry sipped his tea, still stunned. The Okabes were so casual and relaxed, so American, even in the way they mentioned the terrible things that happened to them at Camp Minidoka.
What was that about a shooting? Henry asked.
Oh, that. The way Mr. Okabe said it made it sound all the more strange. It was obviously something bad, but he was so used to living with the pain. Living here must do that to a person, Henry thought.
A man, I think his name was Okamoto, was shot for stopping a construction truck from going the wrong way.
one of the soldiers escorting the convoy shot him.
Killed him. Right there, Mr. Okabe said, swallowing hard.
What happened to him? Henry asked.
The soldier, not the man who was shot.
Nothing. They fined him for unauthorized use of government property. And that was it.
Henry felt the silence settle heavily on all of them.
What use? What property? He asked after a moment.
Mr. Okabe choked up as he looked to his wife and drew a deep breath.
The bullet, Henry,
Keiko's mother finished the story.
He was fined for the unauthorized use of the bullet that killed Mr. Okamoto.
Farewell, 1942. Since it was Saturday, Keiko had no school, and since Henry was a very special visitor, her parents let her skip her chores for the day. Just this once. So while her mother did the laundry and the mending, and her father helped new families settle in on their block, Henry sat on the steps outside their building and talked to Keiko for the better part of the afternoon. If there had been a more quiet, more romantic part of the camp, they would have found it. But there wasn't a park, or even a tree taller than a shrub for that matter. So they sat on cement blocks, side by side, their feet touching.
When are you leaving? Keiko asked. I'm going to leave with the volunteers when the 5:30 whistle blows. I'll just cluster in with them at the gate, wear my button, and hope to get through. That's where Sheldon will be meeting me, so at least I'll have someone to vouch for me.
And what if you get caught?
That wouldn't be so bad, would it?
I'd get to stay here with you.
Keiko smiled and rested her head on Henry's shoulder.
I'm going to miss you.
Me too, Henry said. But I'll be waiting for you when this is all over.
What if it's years?
I'll still wait.
Besides, I need time to get a good job and save money.
Henry could hardly believe what he was saying. A year ago, he'd been working in the kitchen of Rainier Elementary. Now he was talking about taking care of someone. It sounded so grown up and somewhat frightening. He hadn't even dated Keiko, really. Not when they were both on the outside of the fences. But a courtship could take a year, or several years. Even in his family, where his parents often argued over the tradition of using a matchmaker for Henry, nothing was decided. Would they even let him date American girls? It didn't matter now that his father was so frail. Despite Henry's guilt, he would have to make his own decisions from now on. He'd follow the intent of his own heart.
How long will you wait for me, Henry?
As long as it takes. I don't care what my father says.
What if I'm an old woman? Keiko said, laughing. What if I'm in here until I'm old and my hair is gray?
Then I'll bring you a cane.
You'd wait for me?
Henry smiled, nodded, and took Keiko's hand. He didn't even look. Their two hands just seemed to fall together. They spent the better part of the day beneath that cloudy sky. Henry looked up, expecting rain, but the wind, which kept them a little chilly, blew the clouds south of the camp. There would be no more rain. As the hours passed, they talked about music, Oscar Holden, and what life would be like when Keiko's family came back to Seattle. Henry couldn't bear to tell her that Neo-Machi was disappearing. Building by building, and block by block, it was being transformed, bought out and renovated. He wondered how much, if anything, would be left by the time they got out. The Panama Hotel, like the rest of Japantown, was boarded up now, slumbering like a patient in a coma. He never knew if they would sit up, or just drift off and never wake up again. As the evening shift changed for the many volunteers who worked inside Camp Minidoka, Henry said goodbye to Keiko's family once again.
Her little brother even seemed to regard Henry with a sense of longing. I guess even he knows I have a connection to the outside. A freedom he's not allowed, Henry thought. Holding Keiko's hand, he walked with her, as close to the volunteer gate as possible without being seen. They stood behind an outbuilding and waited for a crew of workers and missionaries to pass by. Then Henry would disappear into the crowd and head to the gate. He hoped Sheldon would be waiting on the other side.
I don't know when I'll see you again. It took all I had to come see you this time, he told Keiko. Don't come. Just wait. And write. I'll be here. You don't have to worry about me. I'm safe here. And it won't be forever.
Henry hugged her close and felt her small arms around his shoulders. Leaning in, he felt the warmth of her cheek in the cool autumn air. Their foreheads touched as he looked down into her eyes, rolling clouds moving slowly in the reflections. His head turned to the left as hers did the same, and a simple kiss found a home between their lips. When he opened his eyes, hers were beaming back at him. He hugged her one more time, then let her go, walking backward, waving, trying not to smile too broadly, but he couldn't help it. I love her. Henry paused at the thought. He didn't even know what that was or what it meant, but he felt it, burning in his chest, feeling fuzzy inside. Nothing else seemed to matter. Not the somber crowd of camp workers drifting to the barbed wire gate. Not the machine guns in the towers above. Henry began to wave, then lowered his hand slowly as the words, I love you, rolled off his tongue. She was too far away to hear it, or maybe he didn't make a sound. But she knew, and her mouth echoed the same statement, as her hand touched her heart and pointed at Henry. He simply smiled and nodded, turning back to the gate. Angry Home, 1942. Henry sank into his seat and spoke very little on the long bus ride home. He truly felt bad, imagining the concern he had caused, but he'd had to go, and he'd deal with the consequences. There was a strange abiding comfort in knowing he could no longer let his father down. Not anymore. What more could there be to disappoint him? What more could he withhold from Henry as a punishment? His mother, though, he worried about her. He'd left an additional note on his pillow for her to find later, just a little something to keep her from worrying. Too much, anyway. The note told her that he was going to visit Keiko, that a friend would be coming along to keep him company, and that if all went well, he'd be home by late Sunday night. The money jar on his dresser was empty, so she'd assumed that he had plenty of money for the trip. But in his entire life, he'd never been gone overnight. This would worry her immensely, especially with his father ailing. When Henry had left Seattle, he'd imagined that he felt the same way his own father must have felt, leaving home at age 13, scared, excited, and confused. For his father, leaving at age 13 was a matter of pride, even though, deep down, Henry sensed a lot of emptiness and sadness along with it. Now, on the bus heading home, he knew what his father had felt, hurt and loneliness, but also a need to do what was right. To his father, that meant helping causes back in China. To Henry, it meant helping Keiko. When he and Sheldon finally said their goodbyes at the Seattle bus station, Henry was exhausted, despite having slept on the bus all day.
Everything gonna be okay for you back home? Sheldon asked.
Henry yawned and nodded. Sheldon looked at him, his eyebrows raised in concern.
I'll be fine, Henry reassured him.
Sheldon stretched and said,
Thank you, sir. You have a fine day now.
And headed for his home, walking in the direction of South Jackson, suitcase in hand. Henry had assured him it would all be okay. But now, walking up the steps to his apartment, he realized it barely felt like home anymore. Somehow it all felt smaller, more confining. But he knew it was the same place he'd left. The door was unlocked. A good sign. Inside, everything was dark and quiet. Their small home had a humid smell of rice cooking, and the burnt raw tobacco smell of the Camel cigarettes his father favored. His mother smoked them too, but not as frequently as his father had. That was the one thing that had changed when his father fell ill. His ability to smoke had disappeared, along with his desire. What Willie had left seemed aimed at denying Henry's existence and focusing on the maps of the war in China. The only light was a small ceramic lamp in the kitchen that his mother had made at the Yuk Fun Artisan Shop years ago, before he was born. She'd had such a different life before Henry came along. He wondered whether she'd returned that life if he ever left. Next to the lamp was a small plate of food, cold rice and wind-dried sausages made from duck. Henry's favorite. Looking over, he saw his parents' door was all but closed. Henry wasn't sure what surprised him more, that his mother had left such a nice dinner for him, or that she wasn't sitting here waiting for him, ready to pounce on his every excuse. The silence was numbing. He grabbed a pair of chopsticks and took the plate of food to his room, setting his small suitcase down just inside. He was stunned and confused as he looked at his bed and saw a large black suit laying there. On the floor were a pair of brown leather dress shoes that looked two sizes too big. The suit jacket was Western in cut, but had an embroidered spiral design on the pocket, his mother's doing, modern, but giving it a touch of the Orient, a sense of place in a modern world. Then it hit him. My father's dead. Henry had never worn such a fine suit in his entire life. The nicest clothes he had were the ones he wore again and again to Rainier Elementary. He wore them several days in a row, doing his best to keep them clean. Then his mother would hand wash and dry them, and he'd wear them again. His appearance was more important to her than the fact that he was teased mercilessly for being too poor to have any other school clothes. But as Henry touched the fine fabric of the suit, he remembered that it wasn't white. If Henry were to wear such a suit to his father's traditional funeral, surely his mother would have insisted that he, as the birthright son, wear the color of his father's traditions. White was a funeral color, not black. This suit would never do. Henry opened his door and stepped across the hall to his parents' room. Peeking in, he could see his mother sleeping and the outline of his father. Henry could hear his father's jangled breathing, no better, but no worse than when he'd left 3 days ago. His father hadn't died. Henry sighed and felt his guilt make room for quiet relief. Back in his room, Henry sat on the bed, looking at the suit, eating his cold dinner. The sausage was sweet and chewy. Fresh, too. His mother must have made it while he was away. Chewing the last bite, he noticed the corner of a small envelope that must have been tucked in the inside breast pocket of the suit jacket. Reaching in, he opened the jacket, which now looked too big for him. It was his mother's way. Everything had to have room to grow. Everything had to last. Pulling out the envelope, he touched the label, which read, China Mutual Steam Navigation Company. It was a cruise line. Henry didn't have to open it to know what was inside. It would be tickets. Passage to China. It's for you. From your father and me. His mother was standing in his doorway, wrapping herself in a flowered robe, speaking to Henry in his familial Cantonese, a language he hadn't spoken all weekend. Japan is losing, she said. The Kuomintang has forced the Japanese Imperial Army north, once and for all. Your father has decided you can go to Canton now, to finish your Chinese schooling.